Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now we talk about nightmares. The rhetoric of the far right depicts the world as a bleak and bitter night, dark and full of terrors. And one of those terrors is Antifa.
We had somebody get on a plane from a certain city this weekend. And in the plane, it was almost completely loaded with thugs wearing these dark uniforms, black uniforms with gear and this and that. They're on a plane.
Where is this?
I'll tell you sometime, but it's under investigation right now.
That investigation, if indeed there ever was one, never surfaced. But in the landscape of that cold, dark night, Antifa terror took hold. Terror misplaced.
So Antifa is a loose collection of hundreds, maybe a couple of thousand radical groups and people, generally the far left, who share an ideology and tactics.
NBC News reporter Brandi Zadrozny has traced the twisted path of conspiracy theories through the web, including the one surrounding Antifa.
The way that I best describe it is, if you see a Nazi, punch a Nazi, you don't go call the cops and say there's a Nazi. And it's rooted in the idea that, you know, the Nazi Party would have never come to power in Germany if people had literally fought them in the streets. I think the idea behind the anti-fascist ideology is that fascism and the far right is inherently violent. It violates and it hurts marginalized people, people of color. They believe that it is inherently right to fight, sometimes violently, a movement and the far right that is violent itself.
Antifa stalwarts are, by definition, looking for a fight, and there has been violence. But they offer far less of a threat in terms of numbers, firepower, actual bloodshed, and mission than the heavily armed, self-styled guardians of the American way, who believe they must take arms to defend it and themselves.
We're literally standing at the cusp of a post-American world. Are you all in, over?
I ain't got nothing holding me back, Tripp. It kills me, it kills me.
But the cadres unleashed by the current president are full of mixed motivations. Some are big caliber bullies who just want to shoot something. Some are proud boys who burn Black Lives Matter banners and deface black churches, enraged and threatened by a nation that's changing. That's what they see. Then there's that vast array of people horrified by what they don't see, but hear on the internet. Those enlisted in the conspiracy theory called QAnon believe that Donald Trump is working tirelessly to rid the world of left-leaning politicians and celebrities who prey on children and eat human flesh.
I have been digesting information from my guides about what this light worker in human form, looking like the name Donald Trump, has been doing for the entire human collective.
QAnon at its core is this belief in good versus evil, right versus wrong, of biblical proportions. And so almost like evangelical Christianity, they are winning souls.
Brandi Zadrozny kept us updated throughout 2020.
They call it red pilling. How can I red pill my husband? How can I red pill my neighbor? Often the answer is, you know, a YouTube video or have them join this Facebook group. In the most recent groups that formed around Save the Children, the people who have organized these groups are major QAnon believers. They post videos, they say, here's what you need to know. And there are people saying, oh my God, I never knew.
Nothing as we know it is true. Yes, there is good in the world, but our world is being run by evil.
QAnon has a hashtag that's really popular, and it's We Are the Media Now. And they're not wrong. They've been very good for years at hijacking hashtags, hijacking trending topics, getting things into the national conversation through the president's Twitter account. A QAnon proponent is headed for the halls of Congress.
If you aren't aware at this point that we are at the precipice of like the dawning of the ages, like then I don't know what you're doing. You're still asleep.
If I'm being really honest, I feel scared a lot. They claim in the open to be there to save the children, or they're patriots, or, you know, they're just evangelicals who love Donald Trump. But when you get into their private groups, it's just post after post wishing mass murder on, you know, their political enemies or members of the media to which I belong. I talked with this guy, Scotty the Kid. At the end of our conversation, you know, I said, tomorrow after I report this, you're going to call me a pedophile. And all the people on your page are going to call me a pedophile. And I can't have a public Instagram page because you guys send me pictures of my own kids. It's very upsetting. So could you not do that tomorrow? And he said, yeah, I won't do that. And he said, and I don't think you're a pedophile, but your boss is. You want to think that you can make a human connection. And I think it's beyond that.
Jeff Charlotte, an author, scholar, and journalist with a focus on religion, recognizes a certain Christian-adjacent idea in such certainty and suspicion, one that can be traced back nearly 2,000 years to the heretical movement known as Gnosticism.
One of the things that makes Gnosticism a nice metaphorical frame for Trumpism is it presents the divine as this sort of series of contradictions. Probably the most famous Gnostic text, The Thunder, Perfect Mind. It's a quite lovely poem, and it's sort of set up as a divine voice that is speaking, I am the scorned and the revered, and so on.
I am the one whom they call law, and you have called lawlessness.
The deep state is what the Gnostics would have viewed as the church, the bishops, the authorities, the so-called experts. They called them waterless canals. And beyond that is what they called the depth that you experience not through fake news, not through experts, not through even elections. You just know. You don't have to trust expertise. You don't have to trust those who have put in the work of developing bodies of knowledge. Because here's the Americanized aspect of this Gnosticism, is it has a small d democratic veneer, which is to say that you make this gospel through your research. You too can become an expert in the technology of voting machines with just a few hours on Parler and a few YouTube instructional videos. They said, I am finding out for myself. I personally am helping President Trump make America great again because I am making the real knowledge that is beyond the fake knowledge, the fake news.
And in this kind of world, experts and journalists, they're not just misguided, they're enemies.
The press is functioning for Trump the way that Jews functioned for the Tsar, that communists functioned in the Cold War. They could be anywhere. Within this kind of Trumpian Gnosticism, it is very much people like you and I, Bob, who are laboring in the veil of delusion, both promulgating the conspiracy, but we're also sort of trapped in the conspiracy. We can't actually see the truth because we haven't done the hard work of research. How can so many Americans embrace what to many of us looks like authoritarianism or even full fascism in the true ideological sense, and yet insist that they're not? It's because you're helping make it happen. It feels democratic, even as it does away with even the need for democracy.
So the mind of the ascending right that enabled Trump's march to political dominance, causing much celebration and some consternation within the GOP, has no use for democracy. It never has had use for it.
One of the things that Jimmy Carter realized when he became president was that a lot of people who wanted to vote had a hard time voting. You know, the same kind of stuff we see now.
Rick Perlstein is a historian of American conservatism and author, most recently, of Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980.
So one of the first major initiatives he undertook as president in the spring of 1977 was to come up with a comprehensive voting reform plan, proposing to have a constitutional amendment to end the Electoral College and to have same-day registration. When he announced this, there was overwhelming support from both parties. But lo and behold, the right wing of the party cried foul. The right wing magazine Human Events called it euthanasia for the GOP. Another figure enters the story, Reagan, the former governor of California, who's, you know, making a tidy living, writing newspaper columns and giving radio addresses every day. He calls this a horrifying prospect. And he revives that story of civil servants voting because their bosses tell them to, of dead people voting. One of Reagan's arguments was that Jimmy Carter won in Minnesota because of same-day registration, and that he wanted to, you know, use this kind of same-day registration scheme to assure Democrats won every election. And once again, the argument is Republicans are harmed when more people vote. You know, 1980, the Christian right held a massive rally for ministers in Dallas. One of the speakers, Christian right pioneer, a new right organizer named Paul Weyrich, who gave a very famous speech.
They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Matthew Sitman, once a conservative Catholic, now a progressive one, is associate editor of the liberal Catholic journal Commonweal. He also co-hosts a podcast, Know Your Enemy, Tracking the Intellectual Drift of the Extreme Right, which is why I suspect he named his podcast with some irony, because as he's observed over and over again, religious conservatism has migrated to Trumpism, which views what was once the opposition as the enemy, which must be vanquished now and forever. That enemy being political liberalism.
Liberalism is not the partisan contemporary political meaning, but liberalism is a political philosophy grounded in individual rights, human equality, the rule of law, due process, constitutional governments are what they're rejecting, especially the individualism and the equality of it. When you take aim at human equality, that's also the foundation of democracy. One person, one vote. That is what they're rejecting. They're saying that actually they know better. They are no longer speaking the language of a democratic majority of the people being with them. They are saying we must crush our enemies because we know what the highest good is. That move from democracy to simply saying we're right is the essential thing. And my concern is that these conservative intellectuals are creating the conditions or giving themselves permission to go along with what amounts to authoritarian rule by a political party that doesn't have anywhere close to the support of a majority of Americans.
You said that within 20 to 30 years, it's possible that 70% of senators will be representing 30% of the country?
By 2040, it's predicted that 70% of the country will live in 15 states. That means that 70% will be represented by only 30 senators. That number is actually not radically different than what has existed at other periods in our history. But what makes it so deeply troubling is that never before has our country been polarized the way it is. The difference between rural voters and urban and suburban voters is so great that the system's structural problems are running into the buzzsaw of polarization that it'll be balanced kind of radically against the Democratic Party.
On his podcast, Sitman quoted conservative-turned-moderate Damon Linker, who wrote, "When social conservatives thought that they were the moral majority, it made sense for them to dream of exercising real political power. When they recognized they were a minority, it made sense for them to resign themselves, to adopt a defensive posture, and prepared to live out their days in the country as dissenters from the reigning liberal consensus. What makes no sense is for social conservatives to think that they can be both weak and strong at the same time. A minority that wields the power of a majority. Unless, of course, social conservatives no longer care about democracy."
He put it very well. The key is to implement the highest good, to implement the order they think is true and just and good. And the ways you get there matter less.
So that brings us to the end of our review of 2020's Lethal Lies and Terrible Truths. But listen between the lines, and you'll hear the wind blowing over the virgin territory before us. The chance to replace America's founding myths of justice and equality with something real and durable.
The bill has come in. It's not coming in. It is in.
That's James Baldwin in 1964, speaking about housing racism in San Francisco.
And the great question now is precisely what we've got in the bank. This, of course, is everything we think we have. Everything.
I think Trump's most shattering legacy isn't the lies he told, but the truth he exposed. Well, we always have next year. Am I right?
That's it for this year's shows. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Eloise Blondio. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Merry Christmas, everybody.